and Exhibition Workers Association was, we would be a sort of an organization centered out of Parkdale, and we would have meetings. We would invite the workers to come, and we would explain their legal rights, and we would sort of try and bring them together as an association, exchange experiences, give them some sort of educational support. And so we would get flyers together, and we would go stand outside the Dufferin gates at Parkdale, and we would hand them out. And often the workers were afraid to be seen talking to us, just like they would in an organizing campaign. One of the things I want to talk about in regards to these employee associations is this: we weren't a union. The Exhibition Workers Association was not a trade union. We would not qualify as a trade union under the Labor Relations Act. We were a sort of a support, advocacy, educational organization, and that meant that as an association, we had no legal rights. We could not demand that the employer meet with us. We could not bargain. We couldn't, if we called the employer and said we'd like to talk to you about working conditions, they could hang up on us, tell us to get lost. We had no right to be on their property, and in fact, they would come out, they would send people out and tell us to get off their property when we were leafleting, so we had to stand out, make sure we were off exhibition property. And worse than all of that, if those workers were seen with us or joined our association and some of their managers found out, they could be fired, and there wasn't anything we could do about it. I mean, we could, in theory, bring a small claims action for wrongful dismissal, but the point is, they were not covered by the Labor Relations Act's provisions on anti-reprisals for collective activity because there was no union. The Labor Relations Act protects trade union activity and people who support trade unions, but it doesn't protect people who just join other sorts of associations. And I'm going to come back to that later because it's part of the sort of the big argument. Okay. So the point is that there's nothing in our laws that supported an employees association that was trying to represent or advocate on behalf of workers at the CNE. And no real union would bother organizing these people because the jobs only last 3 weeks. It would make no sense to try and organize and bargain a collective agreement. By the time they even get to a vote of a certification campaign, everyone will be gone, right? So there's no real unions going to organize these people, and there's no law to protect non-union employee associations. Okay. Okay. Now the second story that I want to start with. When I was, oh God, now I have to try and do this again. When I was an articling student and a summer student, and then back to becoming a lawyer. Steph, do you think I could give you this and you
sure.
could just try and
I'll work on it.
Hit that Walmart thing as I'm talking? One of the cases I got early on in my legal career involved a store, a Windsor Walmart store. And I remember in 1996 going to a hotel in Toronto late one night and meeting with these workers of Walmart at Windsor. And they were telling me what was going on there. And the employees, of course, many of you will realize this, the employees of a Walmart, most of them didn't work regular hours. There were full-time workers, there were part-time workers, there were people who just come in for a few hours after school, there were people that only work weekends. And so it was difficult for the union organizers to find these people. It's not like sitting at a Ford factory where everyone shows up at 7 a.m. for their shift and you can just sort of leaflet them coming out. And the union organizers, of course, weren't allowed onto a Walmart property, and Walmart was quite keen on paying attention to this sort of thing. So most of the organizing of the Walmart store had to be done by the employees of Walmart, which is a dangerous venture, as you can imagine. But they did manage to sign up 91, so they got 91 union cards out of about 200 employees by the time I had met with them late that night at the hotel, and we were getting ready to file an application for certification. Okay. And so we had about 42% of the bargaining unit, and the law that the Mike Harris government had passed just the, you know, the year before had introduced this mandatory ballot process, and you needed 40% in order to get a vote, and that's still the law today. So we had 42%, which is not ideal. Normally the union would try and go in with about 60%, assuming they would lose a bit. But we had 42%, and it had stalled because Walmart had learned of the campaign, and all hell was breaking loose, right? So we filed our application for certification. And under this new law that the Mike Harris government had put in that gives, you know, there's going to be a quick vote. It's a week later, but it still gave Walmart a week to really coordinate its campaign. And so a whole swarm of Walmart executives came racing to Windsor. And they wandered around the store for 7 days, engaging people in one-on-one conversations, holding captive audience meetings. And the Walmart strategy was basically to plant the seed that if the union won the vote, that the store would close. Okay. Now, they had a very sophisticated legal advice where they never came out and said that, but what they said was if, you know, in case you're wondering if we would close the store if the union won, our lawyers tell us we shouldn't answer that question. Right. And so the one thing that everyone talked about that entire week was would Walmart closed the store. So the vote was held and the union got creamed. We lost 151-43. Right? So we went in with 91 union members and we only got 43 votes. So we lost some people along the way. So we got creamed. But of course the union and the lawyers thought that that vote result didn't reflect the true wishes, that they all thought that they were actually voting about whether they should keep their jobs or not. So we filed an unfair labor practice complaint. That got litigated over a long period of time. It took a year and a half to actually litigate this case. And eventually the Labor Board agreed with us and ruled that Walmart had basically threatened to close the store. And so as a remedy, they certified Walmart. Now, some of you might know this history. And there was a big, you know, a big celebration. The Walmart people that had helped organize it, a big party. We had a cake. And then the real battle began. Right? Now the union had to bargain a collective agreement. And Walmart, of course, didn't just accept the Labor Board decision. They never accept any decision. They filed an application for judicial review, which tied the union up for a while at the courts. There were more legal expense. Eventually, the union won that judicial review. Walmart was also, by the way, busy lobbying the Harris government at the same time to repeal the law which would allow the Labor Board to certify the union if the union if the employer commits an unfair labor practice. So that law was changed at the same time. And during all of this, Walmart eventually gets down to bargaining with the union. Now, of course, their position is we're not going to give you anything that would cause other Walmart employees at other stores to think there's any benefit whatsoever in joining a union. Right, so they go into bargaining and they say, well, we're not giving you anything, and which of course they're perfectly allowed to do under our duty of bargaining good faith laws. It's called hard bargaining, and Walmart hard bargained. They said, we're not going to give you anything. We'll talk to you. We'll sit here for as long as you like and discuss your proposals, but we're not giving you anything. So they agreed on some minor things, and of course our law gives the union a weapon if it doesn't like the employer's bargaining position, and what is that?
Strike.
A strike, right? So Walmart...
Strike just broke out
right there.
Yeah,
what's that?
Is Walmart calling?
Oh, it's a phone. Okay, and so Walmart basically says if you don't like what we're offering, go on strike. Now here's the problem for the union, right? The union knows that it can't win a strike, right? It could go off on strike, but Walmart will keep the store open. They will use managerial people to run it. They'll probably hire replacement workers, which is also legal. There was another Windsor down the street, another Walmart down the street from this one, which is why the union had only gone after the store address. Oh, it's not
right.
A phone. So the union knew that they couldn't win a strike. So the strike vote was not really a real threat to Walmart because whatever harm that a strike could pose to Walmart from one store, the cost of demonstrating to all other Walmart workers across Canada and, you know, and around the world that there's no benefit in joining union way outweighed whatever cost they would incur from a strike at one tiny little store in Windsor, Ontario. Right?
Someone's phoning us.
Yeah, probably one of those Twitter people that was yelling at me. So the union couldn't really strike, and they knew that. You know, the right to strike sometimes isn't much of a right at all, right? The union eventually agrees to some very basic terms that get the employees basically nothing. Few little things in there that Walmart was prepared to throw just to kind of make it go away and to make it look like they're bargaining in good faith. And then the union puts it to a vote. And they put on the ballot that, you know, basically you either ratify the collective agreement or you agree to a strike. And the union, you know, holds a vote, says that the collective agreement is ratified. And then all hell breaks loose because a bunch of employees go get a lawyer and claim that there was fraud in the vote, that they had all voted against the collective agreement, so that the union must have done some fancy counting. And also they lodged a complaint about the form of the ballot, saying that it wasn't a fair ballot to give people only a choice of accepting the collective agreement or going on strike. And that ended up in another legal change about what can go on a strike, a ratification ballot. So the union gets tied up in legal battles for another year and a half about the ratification vote. By the time all of those legal proceedings are over, the collective agreement has already expired. And so in 2000, the union just decides to give up and walks away. It abandons its bargaining rights. And so ends another chapter in the attempts of unions to organize retail workers in Canada. Right? And I can tell the exact same story about Eaton's. Right? Although Eaton's workers actually went on strike in the 80s during Christmas. And Eaton's just kept the store open and continued to work, right? So we have a pattern here, and I open with these two stories because they're sort of give me the platform for what I really want to talk about. They demonstrate how difficult it is for low-wage retail fast food workers in Canada to access collective representation, either through a traditional union or through some other form of worker association that isn't a union. The law is stacked against them. Okay. Now, these are just two case studies, and I understand that there's the occasional success story, right? There's, you know, the same union that I did all that work for, the retail wholesale department store, had actually represented employees at the Bay for quite some time and were able to bargain some collective agreements there. The grocery industry is kind of an example of where unions have been able to get a foothold. Although even the grocery stores, the Metro and the Loblaws are under significant threat now, right, with the new big box non-union stores coming in. It's harder to find examples of successful traditional union collective bargaining in the small little coffee shops, hence the baristas. I picked baristas because they're just in the news lately, right? There were a bunch of newspaper stories about some coffee shop organizing in the Maritimes that reporters had called me and maybe some of you guys about. So when we step back and look at the big picture, you know, sort of historically over the past 60 years, what we find is that unions really have not been able to make any gains in the sort of fast food retail sector except for the odd exception here and there. There's some Care of Foods type organizations, but you know, if you look at the Walmarts and the Targets and the Starbucks and the McDonald's, none of these are unionized, and it's not because the workers are not interested, at least not always, right? There's a legal explanation that's part of the story. Now, retail is Canada's largest employment sector right now. I'm just pulled some stats out. 11.5% of Canadians work in retail. But it's also among the least unionized, right? So I looked the other day, in accommodation and food services, because we're talking about baristas, the unionization rate has hovered for about a decade somewhere between 6 and 7%, okay, in Canada. And unions know, right? Unions know that it's extremely difficult to win an organizing campaign at one of these little places, and even more importantly, perhaps, to actually bargain a sustainable collective agreement that will last beyond one or two terms before, you know, the union ends up being decertified, right? It's extremely difficult, and it's expensive to put all these resources into organizing a second cup or a Starbucks store, right? So there's relatively few few unions actually trying to organize these workers. I looked it up just to give you an idea of, again, focusing on accommodation and food services. In 2011 and 2012, which is the last numbers we have, a total of three applications for certification were filed in Ontario, representing 65 workers. Okay. And I can go back to 2010-11, there were 5 applications. 2009 and 10, there were 10. The year before that, 10. The year before that, 6. Right. So unions aren't organizing these people. You know, there's the odd little example that you get in the newspapers, right? And probably part of the reason they're in the newspaper because it's so unusual, right, for a union to be organizing one of these coffee shops. So the next question then is, can anything be done about this, right? If we accept, and maybe most of the people in this room accept, that service sector fast food workers should have at their disposal some means of acting collectively to improve their working conditions, how could we redesign a labor law model? Right, I'm coming at this from a law perspective, right? And well, I mean, that kind of question's been asked for years, right? And we know how to design a labor law model that could encourage more unionizing in this sector. There's no big mystery to it, and labor law people like me have been writing about this stuff. I do it, and, you know, most of the time I'm writing these articles about, with my brilliant ideas about how the law could be changed, but I don't expect anyone to listen to it, right? All the other union side labor law people nod along, right? So we know, I mean, we could go back to a card check system instead of the Mike Harris mandatory ballot. We know empirically that unions do better when there's a card check than they do in a vote. We could make access to first contract arbitration easier than it is right now. Although in Quebec, where access to first contract arbitration is almost automatic, Walmart just closed and left, right? So even that, you know, if you got an employer that's prepared to just leave, that's not going to solve your problems. We could give union organizers greater access to the workplace, right? This is another proposal that I and other people have written about. We could improve the right to strike, you know, make it stronger so that, you know, for instance, replacement workers are banned and sympathy strikes are legal. We could try and, you know, borrow from the European models and bring in some form of work councils or industry or sectorial level bargaining. I argued in a paper in the Osgoode Hall Law Journal, it's out right now, that we could be more creative. We could say, for every time the employer violates a key provision of the Employment Standards Act, that their model changes. So they moved from a mandatory vote to a card check, and they lose the right to campaign against the union. You know, this is very clever of me, right, to come up with this, but. The odds of any of these provisions being passed, and at least being sustainable, in other words, you know, the Bob Rae government introduced some changes specifically designed to encourage union organizing in the service sector when he was in power, and they lasted about a year before the Mike Harris government undid them, right? So it's getting more, not less, more difficult to get any traction with these sorts of legal reforms that supporters of collective bargaining have been arguing about for 30 years. Right? We know how to fix it if we wanted to, but there's no political traction. The Conservatives are going in the complete opposite direction, as you guys know, right? We're now looking on the cusp of bringing an Alabama-style right-to-work legislation. The Liberals have shown little appetite for leading the way to promoting collective bargaining. In fact, they've often been on the other side. They've actually been, you know, more often you're seeing Liberals now bringing in back-to-work legislation, restricting the right to strike of TTC workers and so forth. The NDP is obviously the best hope for progressive labor law reform, and their power base is limited. They're increasingly concerned about the perception of the business climate. Just look at their silence on the minimum wage debates right now. They're even afraid to take a position on that for fear of being labeled anti-business. And even, as I said, even when the NDP has passed progressive labor laws, they haven't lasted very long. They tend to be the first thing on the agenda when they're defeated in the next election. So I think there's little reason to believe that the desire for service sector workers for collective bargaining or collective representation will be quenched by labor laws. It's much more likely that laws will actually go in the opposite direction, make it even more difficult for service sector workers to unionize and for unions to get a foothold, right? So where does that leave us then? Well, the picture I've painted so far is a pretty bleak one, if you believe that service sector workers and baristas should have collective representation. Therefore, by necessity, we need to start thinking about other possibilities. Other possibilities for giving baristas and service sector and retail workers a collective voice that doesn't depend upon the traditional Labor Relations Act model that has failed so miserably for the last 60 years. And here I suggest we look to two sources, and one of them is American experience, where they have been dealing with these problems much longer than us. American labor law professors and unions long ago gave up on the NLRA as a means for organizing the service sector, and they've been looking for other strategies. And the second place to look and to consider is the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which, of course, they don't have in the United States, and you know we do, and so there's a question of what role the Charter might play. Steph, if you can start trying to go back and get the next... pull that chart up there. You can sort of scroll up. The United States, is, as I just said, is even more dire circumstances than we are here, right? Their private sector unionization rate right now is about 6%. Right? I mean, many of you probably know that, but just think about that. Right? 94% of the American private sector is non-union. Retail in the United States is a 5% unionization rate in the retail sector. In Canada, as you can see on that chart, we're at around 15% private sector unionization. But what's interesting, of course, when you pull out the public sector from the graph and you simply look at private sector unionization, what you see is a very clear pattern, right? We are following the American trajectory almost identically, but with a lag in the private sector unionization, which is interesting because, you know, Paul will probably remember this, the big debates in the 80s and early 90s was, you know, one of the big debates in the field was between Paul Weiler, labor law professor, ex of Osgood and then at Harvard, and an economist named Leo Troy out of Rutgers, and they had a big debate, and Leo Troy said, and Paul said, well, the reason the American union private union density is declining so sharply is because of American hostile resistance to unions and the poor labor laws. And Leo Troy said, hogwash. The reason is all to do with economic restructuring, globalization, and a declining interest in unions by the American population. And Leo Troy said the Canadian situation will follow the American as night follows day, but with a lag. Leo Troy so far is winning that debate, it appears, right? So if you look at those numbers, there's every reason to believe that Canadian private sector union density will fall to around 10% and then lower in the next 10, 15 years, unless something changes. I don't know what that would be. And Alberta's private sector union density is already at 10%, about to go below it, right? So... things look pretty grim for advocates of collective bargaining in the private sector. And, of course, the government, the conservative governments, are now going after the public sector. Right? That's the next bastion. We're also following the American Republican lead in attacking public sector union density, which so far has held pretty strong in Canada. Now, American unions, looking at this scenario, have been thinking for many years, decades now, about how to organize workers outside of the traditional NLRA model, which is very similar to ours. Right? You have to organize a majority of people in a bargaining unit. The bargaining unit is usually a single workplace. you know, or multiple workplaces of the same employer within a specific geographic region. The American unions have been trying for some time to figure out how to avoid that whole system, which is stacked against them, right? So and there's a bunch of things they've been doing. One of them is neutrality agreements, which I've written about neutrality agreements. For those of you who don't know what it is, the union uses pressure, various forms of pressure to force the employer or pressure the employers into agreeing to a set of rules, a contract that sets different rules of organizing than the NLRA model, right? So they often require the employer to remain neutral, to give the union access to the workplace, to talk to workers, and to recognize the union voluntarily if the union can organize a majority through cards, right? So in other words, the unions are contracting out of the NLRA model, right? Now, we haven't done that very much yet in Canada. The CAW tried it with Magna. There's a few scattered ones. I predicted 10 years ago that these would start to become more common. I thought I was a genius when the Magna agreement came out right after that, but it's kind of slowed down. But that's out there, and there's some interesting legal issues relating to those neutrality agreements. But actually, I'm more interested for the purposes of this talk in the different sort of organizing and advocacy that unions have been using in the retail and fast food sector. I had a slide. The next slide here. Mm-hmm. Click on there. You might have seen, some of you might have seen what's been going on in the United States, right? There was strikes of Walmart employees on Black Friday. There's a whole rash of fast food strikes across the United States. And some of these actions have been organized by traditional unions acting in a non-traditional way. So the SEIU has been very involved in this, sometimes the UFCW in the Walmart. Right? So the unions, I say in a non-traditional way, the unions don't actually have any bargaining rights at these places. Right? They don't have a majority of workers in any particular workplace. They haven't applied for certification through the NLRA. But what they're doing is they're signing people up to become members, and they're organizing protest, right, to try and put pressure on the employers. And sometimes they're going on strike to put that pressure on and to raise awareness. Okay, the Justice for Janitors campaign that some of you might be aware of, right? That was not a traditional organizing campaign where the union went in and tried to organize janitors at a particular building and get a majority and apply for cert. That was the SEIU sort of signing up janitors, across LA or in the other big cities. And trying to put pressure on the big employers, right? The few of the big employers that represent janitors in buildings across these big cities, and trying to use various pressure techniques to get them to agree to voluntary collective agreements, right? And some of these actions aren't actually run or organized by unions at all. They're organized by worker centers and various other worker advocacy organizations, sometimes ethnically based, a particular community of workers in a certain city. Sometimes they're coalitions of unions and advocacy centers and worker centers. Professor Janice Fine, who's at Rutgers and writes a lot about this, she did sort of a survey and found a few years ago that there's over 200 non-union worker advocacy centers in the United States doing this sort of work. Okay. And get to the next one. The United States, they're now starting to call this alt-labor, right? And what they mean by that is it's unions, but sometimes not even unions, other types of employee associations that are trying to organize workers and improve workers' conditions through collective action that is all taking place outside of the NLRA. This is not traditional union organizing. It's non-traditional representation by unions and other non-union associations. And they're trying to use tactics to raise public awareness and sympathy for the plight of low-wage service sector workers. They're trying to pressure politicians, put pressure on business leaders and employers to justify their poor practices. And beyond that, they're providing a menu of services to workers, right, to members who are not members in the traditional sense are not unionized workers of a particular unionized employer, but they're members of the association or of the union. So some of the things they're doing is they're using their bulk power to bargain lower insurance rates. They're bargaining deals to get medical insurance for members. They're bargaining, they're getting prepaid debit cards that save the members on certain cost. They're providing training and education through schools. Right, some of them are looking into and beginning to provide subsidized daycare for members. They're providing dental benefits, subsidized dental benefits. Okay, so there's a benefit to becoming a member, but it isn't a benefit bargained through a collective agreement. Right, it's a member benefits. Right, and they're lobbying and they're engaging in corporate campaigns. Right, they're protesting. They're picking up picket signs in front of buildings. Right. All right, and none of this is tied to winning a majority of workers in a particular workplace. They're ignoring the NLRA. Now, what does all of this have to do with law? Let me try to bring this back. I have a couple of little things here that we need to pass around that I might refer to. Steph, if you could try and get the chart up, which is next. Here's where I want to reflect back. I'll refer to the charts in a minute. I don't know if you can see that, but this is the chart I'm passing around with the check marks on. I want to refer back then to that CNE story I opened the talk with. That was a form of alt labor, you know, some 20 years before that term was invented. A lot of what the Workers Action Center does in downtown Toronto, Dina Ladd's group, that would be kind of alt-labor type work. Let's consider for a minute how our labor laws deal with alt-labor at the moment. If you look at this little chart I handed out, and you can see it here, you probably can't, but on the very top row, the top box is the Ontario Labour Relations Act model, okay, in the private sector. Let's just deal with the private sector where the baristas are for the moment. If you look at the top row, non-union associations and worker centres, right? So these are worker advocacy groups that are not trade unions, okay? And along the top there, I've got a list of the core rights, freedom of association rights. Okay, now you can quarrel, there's others you could put in there, but this is just the basic model, right? So there's a protection from reprisals. In other words, you have a right to join an association and form an association, and you have a right not to be fired by your employer for doing so, right? So freedom from reprisals. Meaningful dialogue, I'm using that as a catchphrase to cover what the Supreme Court of Canada has said is included in freedom of association within the charter, and I'll talk more about that in a second, right? But in a nutshell, it's the right to present to your employer proposals, to make collective representations to your employer through an association, and your employer is required to listen to those or read them and to engage in something called a meaningful dialogue over those representations, right? So the Supreme Court of Canada has said freedom of association includes a right to engage in a meaningful dialogue with your employer about working conditions, okay? Duty to bargain in good faith, that is something that's in the Labor Relations Act, right? If a union gets certified, the employer is legally required to bargain and make reasonable efforts to conclude a collective agreement. Access to government conciliation and mediation, in order to help you reach a collective agreement. And lastly, the right to strike or to access some other form of dispute resolution if bargaining breaks down, the most common one being interest arbitration. Okay? So if you look at that sort of range of freedom of association rights and freedoms, and you look at the non-union associations or worker centers, like my exhibition employees association, we had none of those rights, right? As I said, our workers, the people who joined our association could be fired for doing so because the Labor Relations Act doesn't apply to them. They're not a union. They're not engaging in union activity. So no other law, I mean, they have a right not to be fired without notice, but they've been there for 3 weeks. I mean, notice is basically nothing. The Employment Standards Act doesn't even cover them for notice, right? So they could be fired, and there's nothing we could have done about it. Okay. They obviously, you know, we could not, if our exhibition workers association had encouraged the exhibition workers to go on strike, we would have been committing a tort, conspiracy of interference with economic relations, of inducing breach of contract, right? Now, the law gives unions, trade unions, special exemption from those torts when they engage in a legal strike. But the exhibition, the non-union employee association that just encourages people to go off on strike, isn't protected by those. That would be a tort. And more importantly, probably, if we were found to have committed a tort, we could be liable for damages. Right? So if we shut down the exhibition for one day because there's no workers, in theory, they could sue the employees associated, well, if we existed legally, let's not go too far, but we would be committing a tort with the potential of quite large damages. But more importantly, the employees could all be fired. Right? They're breaching their contracts by not showing up to work. They're engaging in an illegal breach of contract, and they could be fired, and we couldn't stop them. Okay, and certainly the employees association had no other rights. We didn't have a right to engage in meaningful dialogue. There was no duty to bargain. The employer could just tell us to get lost. And in fact, they did tell us to get lost. And there's nothing we could do about it. Other than we could protest. You know, we could protest, but we don't have any legal rights to force the employer to acknowledge our existence. All right. Now, by the way, here's one point to note, right? And down at the bottom of this chart, I have the American situation. Right, the American private sector situation. The public sector is confusing in the United States because it actually often goes by states. But the private sector, where the coffee shops and the Walmarts are, one thing that's interesting is they actually, the American model, the NLRA, the much maligned NLRA, in this respect actually has greater protections. In America, the NLRA protects not trade union activity, but collective activity. Concerted efforts is the language they use in the NLRA, concerted activities for mutual aid. What that means is when a worker center organizes a work stoppage in the United States at coffee shops, for instance, those strikes are legally protected strikes. In other words, those workers could not be fired for engaging in that strike in the United States. Because in the United States, workers are allowed to go on strike even when they're not represented by a majority trade union. That is not true in Canada. Okay? So those fast food strikes that I just had up on the screen, they were lawful strikes by workers employed by non-union employers. That could not happen in Canada. Only unions represented by majority trade unions who have been certified or voluntarily recognized in Canada can legally strike. Okay? And also, the anti-reprisal parts of the NLRA that prevent union people who engage in union activities from being punished or fired apply to people who join other types of worker associations as well. Right? Because this is sort of an important point that most people who don't follow this stuff for a living don't really understand. Our models are different. The United States NLRA protects concerted activities. It's more of a true freedom of association in that sense. Canadian law protects one type of freedom of association only, which is called trade union activity. Okay, so we have the non-union associations have no rights in this country. In America, they do. So what about then minority unions? Let's talk about minority unions. And by minority unions, I mean unions who have members. So you're a member of a union, but that union is not certified as a majority trade union under the Labor Relations Act. Those minority unions have more rights than non-union employee associations in the sense that the anti-reprisal legislation in the Ontario Labor Relations Act applies there. Right. So if you join a union, if I join the steelworkers, if the Walmart employees who became steelworker members were fired before the union ever became certified, the union could bring a complaint, an unfair labor practice complaint, get their jobs back because the Labor Relations Act protects reprisals from trade union activity, right? So at least that box is checked, the anti-reprisal section, if you are exercising your collective action through a trade union. But beyond that, a minority trade union has no legal rights in this country, Right? No, the employer has no obligation to recognize it, no obligation to bargain with it. There's certainly no right to strike. Right? So they just had that one extra right, reprisal, the anti-reprisal right. Okay. So not surprisingly, minority unions in Canada do very little. Right? You don't see minority unions, or engaged in much political activity. Well, I shouldn't say that. Let me back up. I mean, unions engage in political activity, but minority unions have no, independent status here. What happens in the real world is a union tries to organize a workplace to get a majority of the workers. Maybe they get to a vote. If they lose the vote, for the most part, the union moves on. I mean, if it's a close vote, they might hang around and hope that a year later they'll try again. But I've seen lots of times in my career as a lawyer, workers calling a union organizer and the union organizer saying, there's no way in hell we're ever going to get certified, so we can't help you, and move on, right? Because union organizers get measured on whether they organize bargaining units and get certified, right? So unions don't do much outside of the majority, exclusive, they're trying to get certified. If they can't get certified, they move on, right? And I'm not blaming unions for this. They need a sustainable economic model, right? It doesn't make sense to spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars fighting an employer who can just ignore you, right? So you're trying to get certified. Okay. Now, some unions are starting to think outside the box and beginning to think about what could minority unions do, right? In other words, maybe we can't get a majority of this store, this factory, but what if we can get 30%? Right? What if we can get 30% support in that factory? Can we do anything with that 30%? Right, and the most obvious example is Unifor's new community chapters, right, where they are trying to figure out a model that would allow people to join the union and receive some benefits from the union, even though they do not work and probably will never work for, may never work for, a majority trade union certified employer. Right, so there's no collective agreement. Now, the Unifor struggled with this. How do you do this? How do you come up with an economic model that allows you to do this, to provide benefits when you're never going to have a collective agreement? You're never going to have a dues clause checkoff, right? So you're relying upon people paying you some sort of voluntary fee in exchange for these services, right? Well, if you start thinking like that, one thing you need to start realizing is, well, you need to provide a service that's actually going to be useful, in other words, that people will pay for, which is probably a good thing for unions to start thinking about, right? How do we, certainly if right to work's coming, you better have some services that people are going to want to pay for. What I'm interested in, really, and I'll have to pick up the pace here, but what I'm really interested in is how could law help these non-union employee associations and minority unions to provide some sort of effective collective voice outside of majority certified trade union labor relations act type collective bargaining? And here I want to kind of go back to the charter. I don't know how many lawyers are in the room, but I'll say a few things about the charter. I know charter law is quite complicated, but I don't need to go into a lot of detail. Obviously, the charter, so the United States, the alt-labor movement in the United States has some benefits over a Canadian alt-labor movement, in the sense that they have rights to non-reprisal, and they have a right to strike that we don't have here in Canada. But we have the charter, and they don't have the charter in the United States. And the question is, will it matter? Now, you might think, well, for those of you who are lawyers, the charter can't be that useful because the charter doesn't apply to the private sector, and we're talking about the private sector. But I want to explore that a little bit. So we're dealing with Section 2D of the Charter, right, which says everyone has freedom of association. Right? And so the question is, what does freedom of association mean? And it's taken, 30 years to figure that out through lots of litigation, and we still don't really know. And there'll be a bunch more cases this year reaching the Supreme Court of Canada where they're going to try and tell us a little bit more, right? But for many years, just quickly, for many years, freedom of association really meant very little, right? It meant the right to join an association, to form an association, and it meant, in practical terms, that governments could not pass laws prohibiting you from joining an association or the government couldn't pass a law that punishes you for joining an association. But beyond that, it really didn't. That was it. Right? And then things began to change. In the late 90s, I would sort of begin it with a case called Delisle in 1999, and then there was a series, Dunmore, which is in 2001, involved agricultural workers. 2007 was BC Health Services, and 2011 was Fraser. And you take that bundle of cases where the Supreme Court of Canada started to add substance to freedom of association. And it's still quite a modest, what freedom of association means even today after Fraser and BC Health Service is still quite modest. It doesn't include a right to strike yet, all right, although that case is coming to the Supreme Court later this year, whether it includes a right to strike. With the Saskatchewan case and the Canada Post and Air Canada, I'm losing track of them all, right? But certainly the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal case last year said that the charter includes a right to strike, and that one is on the way to Supreme Court Canada. So until it includes a right to strike, that means governments can still pass laws banning strikes. So the Ontario Liberals did it last year, the year before. They said TTC workers cannot strike. Well, that's fine. They can do that if the charter doesn't include a right to strike. Governments can probably still impose collective agreement terms when they're not bargained. That's another issue that's sort of in constantly being debated. But there's a very troubling case from Ontario last year called the Association of Justice Council, where the union bargained for some time with the employer, but they never reached a deal, and then the government said, okay, well, we're going to impose our final offer by legislation. And the Ontario Court of Appeals said, that's fine. As long as the employer engages in bargaining, once that bargaining reaches an impasse, the government can legislatively impose a collective agreement. That case is actually leave in that case was denied, right? So that's the law in that one, right? But anyway, so this is the meaning of the freedom of association is still in flux. How far it will go is in flux, but we do know something. And I handed out another sheet. I forgot to actually put this up on my board, but it doesn't matter. You couldn't see it anyways. If you look at the second sheet that has the gray boxes, the content of freedom of association in the Charter is now, really, you can kind of summarize it in five rights and freedoms that I have in that box, right? It's the right to form and join an association of your choosing. It's the right to be free from reprisals for doing that. Those have been around for a while, but the new ones coming from Dunmore and Fraser... Dunmore, BC Health Services, and Fraser are the right to make collective representations through an association to the employer, an obligation on the employer to acknowledge, read, or listen to those representations, and an obligation on the employer and the association to engage in a meaningful dialogue about those representations. Now, we don't know really what meaningful dialogue means, right? The Supreme Court of Canada has said it means something. It means not just simply dismissing. It means having a discussion. That's what it said in Fraser. And basically the Supreme Court in Fraser said, go back and litigate that question of what meaningful dialogue is, and said it's got to mean something. And it has to have some substance. So it's not much, but it's something. It's more than was there 15 years ago. So that, again, those last three that I have in bold on the handout are what I had in the original handout under the phrase meaningful dialogue, okay? Now, here's the thing. In the private sector, and I've already been through this, the only entity that has the right to engage in those charter-protected freedoms are majority trade unions. Okay, except agricultural workers, strangely enough. They have those rights because they have their own controversial act called the Agricultural Employees Protection Act, which the Supreme Court of Canada upheld in that Fraser case. Okay, so if you're an agricultural worker, you can actually join an association, I think union or otherwise, and you have a right to bring collective representations to your employer who must engage in a meaningful dialogue. But again, we don't know what that means because no one has litigated that question. But if you are not the agricultural employees and not covered by that piece of legislation, you have no right to exercise any of those charter rights. Right. There's no legally protected right. So if you work for Tim Hortons or Starbucks or McDonald's or Walmart and you're not represented by a majority trade union, you have no right to go to your employer and make collective representations, and your employer has no obligation to engage in a meaningful dialogue with you. Right? So what we know is, you know, about, well, because we don't even include agricultural employees in the union density measurement, that tells us that about 85% of private sector workers in Ontario have no effective means of exercising their charter-protected rights, which is, you know, a bit odd, right? You would think. But if you look at the public sector, it's slightly different because, if you, you know, go back to the second chart here. In the public sector, the charter applies directly. So that seems to mean that if you work for the government, you can form and join an association, union or otherwise, and make representations to your government employer, and the government employer is required to engage in a meaningful dialogue with you about those representations, even if you're not a certified trade union. Okay? And whether that's true is actually may be tested shortly, because there's a group of lawyers, legal aid lawyers, I don't know if any of you have come across this case, that are trying to organize, and they're excluded from the Labor Relations Act. And so what they have done is they have said, well, we have a charter-protected right to make collective representations to you outside of the Labor Relations Act, and you are required by law to engage with us in meaningful dialogue. And the employer, the government, Legal Aid Ontario, has said, go to hell. Until you're unionized, which you can't be, we don't have to talk to you. And they have hired the Sack Goldblatt people, and look for the next charter case about to come. But, I mean, my view, and, okay, 5 minutes. It may be that in the public sector you have direct access to these five rights, but in the private sector you clearly do not. You need to organize into a majority trade union. Now, it's an interesting question, by the way, whether if you look at, for instance, at baristas, for the lawyers in the group, you can just give them, here's a good exam question. if you are the baristas, who have basically never been able to unionize in this country, and you had empirical evidence, expert evidence, saying baristas have never, you know, coffee shops are almost always non-union, they've never been able to organize, and you have no other legal means of making collective representations and forcing your employer to engage in a meaningful dialogue, are your charter rights being violated in the exact same way that the agricultural employees' charter rights were being violated by being excluded directly from the Labor Relations Act? That's an interesting question. But I'll leave that aside. I think there's a good political argument that you could make that all workers should have access to at least the minimal charter rights that are guaranteed by the charter. In other words, you could, you know, make a political argument that why shouldn't everyone have the ability to exercise at least the minimal charter rights? And so what I actually argue in this paper here, the graduated freedom of association, what I mean by graduated freedom of association is, what if we had this model? The Labor Relations Act majority trade union exclusive representation model that we've had since the 1940s remains, don't just leave it there. But you graft onto that model the thinner version of the freedom of association, similar to what they have in the NLRA, and similar to what the Supreme Court of Canada has said the charter guarantees. Right? So what I mean by that is, if you can join and organize a majority trade union and get certified, then you're good. You're under the Labor Relations Act, as always have, and you try and bargain, and you have a right to strike, and you have access to conciliation. Nothing changes, okay? Because there's no political will to change any of that. Right? You can keep trying, you keep making those arguments I said, and maybe, you know, you might win them. But for the most part, that model's there. I mean, the Tories want to dismantle it in bad ways. But then, if you cannot organize a majority trade union, let's say you can get 30% of a factory. You just can't, or 40%, 50%. If you get 50% of a factory right now, you have no means of ever getting union representation. Right? You need 50 plus one, right? So you got 50% of a factory. You can't access the traditional trade union model, right? Shouldn't you have a right? So I'll put it another way. What if we had a legal model that basically just grafts on the charter the minimum rights. So in other words, the Labor Relations Act is amended slightly to say you can make collective representations through an association, and your employer must listen to them, receive them, and engage in a meaningful dialogue about them. Right? Basically, you take the Agricultural Employees Protection Act model, with some revisions that I talk about in here, and you add it to the Labor Relations Act as an additional method. You have a thinner version of freedom of association, you have a thicker version of freedom of association, and they work together. Right? And some workers may prefer the thinner version, because we got surveys that show that actually there's very high level of support for collective representation that is less adversarial than traditional trade unions. So those people might be interested in a thinner version. But beyond that, trade unions that can get to 50% but not 51%, could they make use of this model? That's the real question I end up getting to. What if we had that right? What if the steel workers or the UFCW represented 50%? Or the other thing you get at is you don't try and organize a particular workplace. You could. You can try and get 40% and you have one workplace, and then you advocate for them. But what they're doing in the United States, and what this model I think could actually be useful for, is you don't try and organize one Starbucks store. You create a barista's union or a retail workers association, right, that Kendra is thinking about, right? Well, what if the retail workers association had a legal right to actually go into the workplace and force a meeting with the employer and say, here's our concerns, let's have a meaningful dialogue. Now, I understand the employer might say, we're not going to agree to anything, and they couldn't strike. I get that. It's not bargaining. Bargaining is that other, thicker model. This is lesser than that. But the question is, could unions or worker centers or worker advocacy groups make use of a model that allowed them into the workplace to engage in a discussion with the employer? And my view tentatively is, yeah, that would be actually an additional useful tool that even the Americans don't have, right? The Americans have done pretty good with alt labor. They don't have a right to go into the workplace and say, here's what we want to talk about, right? And I think if you think creatively, it would be a different sort of advocacy. You can't think of it as collective bargaining. It isn't, because you have no power. You don't have the right to strike, right? But you do have the right to say, I'll give you one example to kind of introduce, to sort of go into the discussion. What if Unifor was able to build up 25%, this is probably fictional, but say, let's use the Retail Employees Association. Right, this association, and they offer a menu of services, right? Better insurance, some sort of a health plan, daycare, whatever, advocacy, educational training, job placement, and all of these things make it actually beneficial. These retail workers say, actually, that would be a pretty good organization to belong to. I'll pay my whatever, $10 a month, right, or whatever, to get those benefits, right? But the union is able to build up, say, I don't know, a good critical mass. Let's say 15% of retail workers, to pick a number up, join this association. Right? Now, right now, you know, the union has no legal rights to do anything for those workers. But I'm suggesting, well, what if the Retail Workers Association could insist upon a meeting with the Hudson's Bay Company or Walmart and say, we represent 15%, 20% of your workers. And we think you're violating overtime laws, right? Or we think you're underpaying. Now, Walmart has to engage in a meaningful dialogue. Now, that we don't expect that. They're not bargaining. They might say, go to hell. But the question is, could the union then use that go to hell to mobilize, right? In other words, it's a form of communication. You're not bargaining. You're communicating. So whatever Walmart says back, you use that. You know, say, look, Walmart doesn't give a shit about you. We told them that they're violating the law, and they told us to go to hell. Now you can bring that. You can bring an employment standards complaint on behalf of those workers. And if you get the Walmart, if they are violating the law, and you get Walmart to, you go to Walmart and say, you know, you're not even paying overtime pay for these people. And Walmart says, crap, you're right. And then they start paying overtime pay. Well, the union says, look what we did for you, right? In other words, could the union convey this ability to force a meeting with the employer into some sort of effective advocacy that makes them look useful? It's something they don't have right now. And, you know, it may be that the Supreme Court of Canada is leading us to this conclusion anyways. It may be that at some point the Supreme Court of Canada could say, you know, the law has to provide for these basic five rights through some method. And the ILO already says that, right? The ILO says if you have a majority trade union system, you have to have an alternative legal system that allows non-majority employees to engage in collective bargaining in the ILO sense, right? And so you can make an argument, all we're doing here is putting Canada in compliance with basic ILO law or partial compliance, right? The ILO says you also have a right to strike. But politically, you can make the argument, all I'm talking about here is providing the basic fundamental rights that the Supreme Court of Canada has said all workers should have. Right? It would be more difficult to argue against that than it is to argue against the bigger, fancier proposals we all argue for that I mentioned earlier, right? Those are job killers, right? Well, nobody argued that the Agricultural Employees Protection Act was a job killer. The complete opposite. The argument was it's useless, meaningless, does nothing, right? Well, you could use that against the, you know, turn that around and say it's meaningless. Not, you know, everyone says it's meaningless. Well, this, but at least it would give people their ability to exercise their basic charter rights. Then the question would be, could unions and associations make any use of it as one additional tool in the alt-labor strategy of collective representation for workers who have no means of ever accessing traditional majority trade unions? And I'm trying to just start a discussion about that. I don't claim to know the answer. I'm just wondering, and I think you could use it.
Great.
There, I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you, David. Thank you very much.